sure, we might care what Jay Powell is thinking in five words or less, of course. But you know who doesn't care? The bond market, that's who. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday today, the 18th of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The Marketplace number of the day on this Thursday is 1.75. Technically, 1.753. That is in percent. It's the high point of the yield on the 10-year Treasury note today. And yes, we usually do give you that at a different point in the program, but we lead with it today because of what Fed Chair Jay Powell said yesterday, that he and his colleagues aren't all that worried about inflation, actually. Might get a little bit of it, some spikes here and there, but it's not going to become a thing. And the bond market today said, yeah, Jay, no, man.
I think what the bond market is saying is we don't quite agree that these are going to be completely transitory moves. And we do see inflation components along with the growth.
Victoria Fernandez there. She's at Crossmark Global Investments. And if the bond market is right and the Fed is wrong and inflation does become a thing and Mr. Powell and company have to raise rates, perhaps significantly, then mortgages get more expensive, car loans as well, all the stuff you need to borrow money to pay for. And the idea of the Fed maybe not being entirely in control of things, well, that's just not good.
If you've lost confidence that the Federal Reserve actually has a handle on things, then you're very uncertain as to what the market is going to do.
And uncertainty, as we know, well, there be dragons, right? Okay, moving on from the bond market. Anchorage, Alaska is the center of the geostrategic universe today. Top people in the Biden administration are holding their first meeting with their Chinese counterparts. And if you're in the market for metaphors, relations are frosty, especially in the areas of trade and technology. Anchorage, Alaska, frosty. Get it? Anyway, the Trump administration loved its tariffs on Chinese imports, as you know, because we told you like a zillion times. It blacklisted Chinese telecommunications companies and semiconductor makers. And as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports, the Biden White House seems likely to hang tough.
Both sides set low expectations for the summit.
U.S.-China interaction at this point is going to be tough.
Susan Schwab, a former U.S. trade representative, expects the Biden White House to continue a hard line against what it considers Chinese protectionism, hacking, and siphoning American technology.
It looks like the Biden administration's trade policy will look an awful lot like the Trump administration's trade policy, except that maybe not quite as noisy.
Which could mean still cutting off exports where the U.S. and China directly compete, like semiconductors and 5G networks. Wendy Cutler at the Asia Society Policy Institute says this wouldn't come as a surprise to Beijing.
They're taking a more realistic view of where U.S.-China relations are headed. Their economic plan talks a lot about developing self-sufficiency in high-tech areas.
The term often thrown out is decoupling. But the challenge is to find areas, perhaps agriculture, where coupling makes sense, creating jobs in both places, says trade lawyer Claire Reed at Arnold & Porter.
Where are we going to find the places where we stay linked? Because if we're really stupid about it, then we'll descend into a kind of McCarthyism, which will be very bad for the United States.
To that end, the Chinese are expected to ask the U.S. to end tariffs. But there may be a price for that. John Holden is with the consultancy McClarty Associates.
The administration has not unilaterally abandoned some of the Trump moves on China. It wants to gain something in exchange.
He does expect one change, for the U.S. to work with allies on testy China issues rather than going in alone. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
All right, so bonds we talked about, a whole lot going on there. Crude oil took a tumble today, down 7% on worries about not great virus news coming out of Europe. Can't not mention another terrible week for unemployment claims. More than 750,000 people lost their jobs last week. Oh, and stocks? Yeah, stocks. Selling into the close is the phrase you are looking for. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We'll be right back. now about commercial real estate. Google. That's the word. Google. The company announced today it's going to spend $7 billion on real estate this year after taking a pause in 2020. 19 states are in line for pieces of that investment. Data centers, yes, for Google's cloud computing businesses, but also just plain office space, making room for thousands of hires in Atlanta and Chicago, to name just two big cities, and new offices in Texas and Mississippi. Marketplace's Erica Barris now on what all that means.
Google will be meeting workers where they are, says Lisa Pruitt, a law professor at the University of California, Davis, who studies the rural-urban divide.
It does permit people who might have an attachment to, you know, their Midwestern or Southern state or community. It gives them an opportunity to stay.
Investing this much in office space also means the company is expecting workers to go back to the office, says Scott Kessler, an analyst at Third Bridge.
I think they're really signaling that there is a tremendous value in having kind of a base of operations where people kind of congregate and work together in person.
In addition, an expansion like this can build up local goodwill, says CFRA analyst John Freeman, especially where it's building new facilities, like in Mississippi and Minnesota.
Oh, they're the guys right down, you know, they have a little office here, and we know people that work there, right?
Google may need to build on those ties, says Mary Hunter McDonald, a management professor at Wharton.
The strategy allows the company to broaden its relationships with different states in a way that might hopefully engender some broader support from a more varied political constituencies.
Google is facing several lawsuits, and the company is under increased scrutiny from congressional regulators. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Hey, so do me a favor, would you? Tomorrow morning, as you are trying to fulfill your business and economic news needs, listen to the Marketplace Morning Report. David Brancaccio and the gang that gets out of bed way too early. Everything you need to know to start your business day. It can take a good long while for policy changes to show up in the economic data. Brexit, for example, was set in motion almost 5 years ago now, and just now we are getting our first real indicator of what that vote to take Great Britain out of the European Union has really meant. From the Office of National Statistics over in the UK last week, a couple of indicators. In January, when the UK finally actually left the EU after all the Sturm und Drang, exports to the European Union were down 41% compared to December, that is, pre-Brexit. Imports going the other way from Europe to the UK, down 29%. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has been talking to some of the British exporters most affected by all of this, farmers and fishermen.
Here she is. This is my boat. She's the Superbus.
Shell fisherman Alan Steer proudly shows me the most important tool of his trade.
And we'll just climb aboard. She's open-decked, and we work crab pots from her.
Working around 6 miles off the British coast, Steer and his two-man crew haul some 600 crab pots a day out of the sea with the help of a trusty, if rusty, winch. A third-generation fisherman, Steer has no regrets about his choice of occupation.
It's a real way of life. It's not so much a job as a way of life.
But that way of life is now in jeopardy. The vast bulk of what he catches is sold in continental Europe. Fine when the UK was in the EU, his live crabs would reach the continent within a day. But after Brexit, the extra regulation and paperwork means delay.
It can take three or more days, which for a live crab product can be fatal.
Unsurprisingly, perhaps, the European market for his product has crashed.
It was down at least 50% in January. It's probably going to be even more than that in February. We haven't got the figures back yet.
This could put you out of business.
Yeah, dramatically, because the market's not there to take the crab across.
It's not just the British fishermen who are encountering new barriers to trade with the EU. Some pig farmers are also complaining. Jack Bosworth, whose family-run firm owns 2,000 hogs, told Channel 4 News that his meat exports to the continent are also facing long delays at the border.
Our meat exports are liable to 30% checks, so every load that's going through is requiring such scrutiny that on fresh produce that just isn't sustainable.
He says 15% of British pig farmers could go out of business. He notes that UK meat producers are being subjected to far more onerous regulation than those of other countries exporting to the EU.
New Zealand, for example, is another third country, are only liable to 1% checks.
Brexiteers are crying foul, especially since the UK has not yet reciprocated with new checks and controls on EU imports into Britain. John Longworth, a former member of the European Parliament for the Brexit Party, says the UK is being penalised for breaking free from the EU.
They are punishing us for having the temerity to want to have our own laws and our own liberty.
But he thinks the EU is playing with fire. The bloc has a huge trade surplus with the UK, worth over $110 billion a year.
They have a lot to lose by comparison with us, and we need to be tough.
British exporters, he says, should draw comfort from the knowledge that by pursuing its own destiny and vaccination programme, the UK will emerge more quickly from the pandemic than the EU. And he claims all British business will benefit.
The UK economy will grow much more rapidly than the European Union, and there'll be plenty of opportunity for producers to sell.
His words may not console the UK's disgruntled exporters. Some 50% of European trucks leaving Britain, having dropped off goods here, are now returning to the continent empty. The cost of shipping into the EU after Brexit's expected to be five times higher than before. If such barriers are not dismantled, Britain may face a long-term hit to trade with its nearest, but no longer dearest, trading partner. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I really like hit the pavement running.
I mean, that is kind of the way to do it, right? First, though, let's us do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is down 153 today, 0.4%, 32,862 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ tumbled 409 points, 3%, 13,116. The S&P 500 down 58 on the point scale, 1.4%. 39 and 15. Eric Barris told us about Google. Today, parent company Alphabet finished 2.9% to the downside. Elsewhere in tech, Apple, which could be fixing to launch some new high-end iPads next month, if you believe all the hype, and we always somehow do believe the Apple hype, down 3.3%. Spotify, which today put out some new data on how much it's paying out in royalties to artists, tanked 4.1%, so either too much money or not enough. Take your pick. Facebook, whose Reality Labs division is now showing off, for some reason, a supposed mind-reading device to wear on your wrist and an augmented reality keyboard, down 1.9%. Bonds, we did. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Just because retail and shipping and cloud-based web services and whatever else strikes Jeff Bezos' fancy isn't enough, Amazon is getting deeper into healthcare. It's going to expand its Amazon Care telemedicine services, till now available only to Amazon employees in Washington State, nationwide by summertime, the company says. What, though, might it mean, do you suppose, when the company that sells you healthcare sells you everything else, too? Marketplace's Kimberly Adams asked around.
The pandemic led to a sharp increase in the number of people trying out virtual healthcare. Those visits can generate a lot more data than when you just walk into a doctor's office, says Idrissa Jarrett, who teaches business information technology at Virginia Tech.
From a privacy perspective, you know, you have to consider that the breadth of data collection associated with a patient visit is going to be much more significant.
Jared said that element of the health privacy debate applies to any telehealth service. But he says there's another potential privacy concern with this particular company.
So Amazon is a powerful data-driven company that derives much of its competitive advantage from the data that it collects.
Now, Amazon Care says specifically on its website, will never use your health information to sell you anything. Plus, Robert Graybois, a senior research fellow and healthcare scholar at the Mercatus Center, says Amazon probably already has a lot of information about people's medical issues.
If Amazon wants to know about my health today, they probably can just look at my purchases and figure pretty well what's going on in my life.
He says a much bigger concern in his mind is whether a company as big as Amazon will be such a strong force in healthcare that it starts to play an outsized influence in healthcare policy nationwide. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
We gave this a nod up at the top of the program. Another 770,000 people filed first-time claims for state unemployment benefits last week, the 52nd week in a row. The labor market has been a key indicator of this pandemic, a labor market crisis that has been, as we've been telling you, hitting women disproportionately hard. In the past year, more than 2.3 million women have left the labor force entirely, and millions more, something like one in four women, that's according to a study by McKinsey, are thinking about leaving or are adjusting their career plans. We wanted to know what those statistics are like when they're your life. So we got on the phone.
My name's Lauren.
My name's Kelly.
Lauren Pyle is in San Antonio, Texas. Kelly LaFont is in Fayetteville, Tennessee. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Lauren, let me start with you. Tell me, I guess, in a nutshell, what the last year has been like for you. Where were you a year ago and where are you today?
So a year ago, I was sent home from work. We were doing remote. My husband was as well. My 8-year-old, who was in first grade, went virtual with school. So he's an engineer. I'm a public servant. I just kind of worked with economic assistance stuff like SNAP, Medicaid, stuff like that. And yeah, we were just kind of dealing with it.
And so... But you've had to move. Your husband had to look for a job. I mean, there's a whole backstory there. Give me the elevator story on that one.
Yeah. So he got laid off in May. He hit the ground running right away looking for work all summer. He was a stay-at-home dad, and we just couldn't find any work. We were living in South Dakota. So we extended our search to kind of, you know, cities we had on our mental list of places we might want to live. So he got a job. He started in October. My daughter and I hung back and waited for a while to see if that job was too good to be true, and it wasn't. So I went ahead and resigned my position, and we joined him down here in Texas.
Wow. Okay. Kelly, what about you? You are still working the same job, but there's some question as to whether you're going to be able to keep doing it because of everything that's going on.
Yeah. So a year ago, I also went work from home. I work in social services. And my son was able to stay in daycare, but there was some time where the daycare would close. We got sick around November. We got COVID, and my son had to stay out of daycare for a month, and then just continual things started leading to daycare closures and not being able to work and have him in daycare. And it just led us to questioning, is this sustainable? Can I try to hold on to a full-time job and keep a toddler who is in and out of daycare, because daycare is inconsistent with COVID?
Yeah. Yeah. I imagine the mental stress of wanting to stay, but maybe not being able to, is really, really hard.
Yeah. I love what I do. I love working in social services, and I don't want to leave that.
Yeah.
But I want to do what's best for my family, too.
Yeah. Lauren, what does it mean to you to have to have given up your job, not yet found a new one? There are financial hits, and I'm sure mental and wellness hits for you as well.
Check, check, check. Yeah. So, so I resigned in December, and I was kind of going through a lot of change with myself. I was like, well, maybe I should go to grad school. So here I am. I decided to start studying for some exams, and then I just got depressed. I was like, wow, I really need to find a job. So, you know, I've been casually browsing for jobs, but starting around February or so, I really like hit the pavement running, and I haven't found anything yet. And I was really like, when we moved here, I was like, oh, it'll be so easy. Like, I'm super employable. And now here I am, like, I'm really nervous. And that employment gap is getting wider by the day. So all that stuff is, you know, starting to kind of reveal itself.
Yeah. Kelly, what kind of conversations do you have with your friends and maybe even your coworkers about this kind of stuff? I mean, you two are not the only two women in the workforce who are dealing with these challenges.
With friends here, I am one of the only friends that I have that is not a stay-at-home mom. So asking them about their experience as a stay-at-home mom and kind of seeing how they're juggling their finances, balancing that against my career aspirations and going, well, I have a lot of support if I would be a stay-at-home mom, but I'm not really passionate about that. Talking to my coworkers, it's saying, yeah, this is hard. I've kind of been in a weird place where I'm the only one with a toddler, so it's a different experience.
What about the conversations with your husband? And this is none of my business, but these are stressful times in a lot of marriages, and money is at the root of so much stress, even in normal times.
We've been going over the same thing. Is this sustainable? If, you know, we never thought it would last this long, and now it's lasted over a year. And we're going, well, if it continues to last this long, we continue to have daycare closures. How is this sustainable for our family? This constant change for my son isn't great. So we're balancing it. But my husband's very supportive and saying, stay in your job, stay in the workforce since that's what you're passionate about. But if this continues, we may have to have harder conversations.
Yeah. So maybe one of those harder conversations, and I don't know, but maybe one of those harder conversations is, hey, man, it's your time to stay home with the toddler.
Unfortunately, my husband is an engineer as well, so he makes quite a bit more than I do.
Yeah. I'm laughing, but that's the root of this problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And for me, it's like, it was never a question of who was going to stay home if we had to. It was always going to be me because I make way less, you know?
Yeah.
I'd love to say, oh, you be a stay-at-home dad. I'm just going to be the breadwinner now. And I mean, there are people who get by on less. We've done it. But I'm like, I don't want to do that anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's similar for us. As my husband would love to be a stay-at-home dad, but the pay gap is significant. So it's just not sustainable for us.
Yeah. So with this problem now of, I mean, there's a lot of problems, right? There's the gender pay gap. There's the expectation that's put upon women in this society and also women in the workforce. I wonder what you two think of this being a moment where maybe the conversation changes and we have finally some movement on this really big picture issue that is affecting you both in your daily lives. Right? So, I mean, Lauren, what do you think?
I mean, I'm more worried than I am hopeful about the position of women in the workforce right now. I mean, I feel like we're already losing so much. You know, I don't even know the numbers of how many women have had to leave because they're in the same exact position. I would hope that we start to value these helping professions or pink collar jobs, as they say, you know, more. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like, I'm going to suck it up and I'm going to work the jobs that I love because that is what I'm passionate about. I'm not passionate about being a stay-at-home mom either. So I don't really see that ending in the near future. I hope so, but I don't know if that's realistic.
Kelly, last word to you. What do you think?
I'm with Lauren on that too. Is I would hope that this is the time where we start talking about how this has burdened women and that women are at a disadvantage here because they are expected to be the primary caretaker of the family and they typically earn less. But I'm kind of with Lauren. I just don't know that I see anything changing.
Yeah. Lauren Pyle, she's in Texas. Kelly LaFont's in Tennessee. Thanks to you both. I really appreciate it. Best of luck.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out, saw this in Quartz today, some data from Adobe Analytics about how we're shopping and how we are likely to keep on shopping in the after times. Adobe says e-commerce is going to be a $1 trillion a year segment of this economy as soon as next year. Yes, it was going to happen anyway. The pandemic has just speeded it all up, right? Among some of the key growth areas, groceries, e-commerce-wise, up 230% in February 2021 from January 2020. Sporting goods sales up 75%. And perhaps a result of all that overcrowding into that segment, in January of this year, consumers got out-of-stock responses to their orders four times as often as they did a year ago. All right, we got to go. Here's your moment of economic context, truly contextual this time. I mentioned this is the 52nd week in a row. First time unemployment claims have been high, 770,000 people. 53 weeks ago, so the last normal week we had, 200,000 people filed first-time claims. Then a year ago, this week, 250,000. Then that next week a year ago, 3 million. A week after that, 6 million. Amir Bibawi, Siobhan Brett, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.